Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Sengary. We're going to start the morning with open phones. You can hop in the queue at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email us at vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. I'll get to some topics in just a moment, but I am going to tell you we're going to mix things up a little this week. I'm off Friday with Governor Jim Douglas filling in for me. Wow, who can say that? Governor Jim Douglas fills in for me when I take the day off. It's like when Phil Scott was lieutenant governor, and remember he did that Vermont Everyday Jobs tour? It's like he showed up and did your job for that day. That's kind of like what happens around here when Jim Douglas takes over for me, right? But I digress. All right, so at 9:30, I'll have Bob Ney. That's the little shuffle. I'll have Bob Ney on with me because I'd love to get his perspective on the Senator Leahy decision. Then we'll hear from Jordan Berry of 7 Days. She'll be talking about liquor laws in Vermont. At 10, we swing south to the Vermont Jazz Center in Brattleboro. And since it's Alzheimer's Awareness Month, we'll learn about the disease and the role caregivers play in helping their loved ones. That's at 10:30. But for now, open phones. First topic, who do you think will run and for what? Now, I've made a list of every politician or potential politician in the state who should be updating their resumes, and some listeners have suggested some that I missed. So I'll be mentioning a lot of people in this half hour. If I'm missing anyone, please let me know. If you think you should be on the list, call in, announce your candidacy. That's how open phones works. Feel free. Tell me what you're going to run for. Also, tomorrow night is the Danville Wild Game Supper, the 101st year of it. I'm going. I'll talk about that. And if you're a wild game fan, you can let us know. All right, our numbers are 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. Anything else you want to talk about? You know how we play this game. Open phones, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. All right. Let me start on my list as you think about what you want to talk about this morning. I'm going to kind of bounce back and forth. Most of my candidates are Democrats or Republicans. I have a few progressives and possible independents or other parties. But I've mentioned Governor Phil Scott. I think Governor Jim Douglas could be interested if Phil Scott doesn't run for the Senate. Senator Randy Brock, Senator Corey Parent. Rich in Starksboro reminded me of a couple of people that I left off the GOP list yesterday. Bruce Lisman, who has run for governor, who's a successful businessman. And also Martha Rainville. Now, Martha Rainville, if you remember, was the adjutant general. In 2006, she ran when the congressional seat opened up, and she ran against Peter Welch. It was one of the cleanest campaigns, the kindest campaign you've ever had. They did not hurl mud at one another. But Martha did leave the state after that, moved to Washington, and has been working there ever since. That doesn't mean she wouldn't come back and run in a race here in Vermont. There's Brian Duby, and then I'm going to mention somebody who I've always thought would be an outstanding politician. I'm not sure he has the heart for it, but it is Brian's brother Michael, who is the adjutant general here. And Michael Duby, I think, would be an outstanding politician for the Republican Party in Vermont to get on board. We'll see if he would do that, but he really has great accomplishments. He also has, whenever he would talk about deployment and sending our Vermonters to hotspots around the world, it pained him. He had a real soul and caring about those in his charge. All right, I'll flip over to the Democrats. There's Peter Welch, obviously, who probably will run for the Senate. Maui Gray, the lieutenant governor who we spoke to yesterday. Becca Ballant, the Senate pro tem. We got Joe Krawinski, Speaker of the House. Keisha Ram Hinsdale has been mentioned quite prominently. T.J. Donovan, the Attorney General, and Burlington Mayor Moreau Weinberger. Okay, I'll start with those. Let's get Fred in the conversation. We've got the Duke of Newbury with us. Hi, Fred. Go right ahead.
Yeah, good morning.
Morning.
I got two things, Rick.
Are you announcing your candidacy?
Say again?
Are you announcing your candidacy?
Yes.
Okay.
Let's see here. I got two things for
you.
Go ahead. When you exit the show, it sounds like you're playing John Coltrane. Is that true?
That is correct.
Hey, look, you got to do this for the Duke. You got to play some piano boogie woogie.
All right.
You got that one?
Piano boogie woogie. We'll get that at some point. And our guy Danny will look for that. Good.
The next thing is, here's what we need. The country needs this person. He really needs this person. This guy had more common sense than 50,000 politicians we got out there now. We need a Fred Tuttle.
Oh, yeah. The late, great Fred Tuttle.
Isn't it great?
I'm not even – that is – there's something about the name Fred, apparently. But, yes, I wish he was still alive. There's something about just common sense and just knowing, right? And Fred Tuttle did indeed.
Really? I mean, it's unbelievable. Yeah. This guy was so good.
Yeah.
I mean, as a matter of fact, I was living in New Hampshire, and he was on television, and he started to talk, and I said, my God, this guy is unbelievable.
Yeah.
And I was just a kid. I was only about 30.
The man with the plan.
He was so good.
He was good. Fred, that's a great suggestion. I'd add him to my list, but unfortunately we lost the great Fred Tuttle. But
I know, it's too bad. Don't forget Boogie Woogie, though.
All right, Boogie Woogie, Piano Boogie Woogie. We'll get our guy Danny on that. All right, excellent suggestion by Fred, the Duke of Newbury. He is not announcing his candidacy. He is a Duke already. I think he has reached the office that he's always wanted to attain. So congratulations to Fred. Yeah, Fred Tuttle, for those who don't remember, ran in the Republican primary against John McMullen, who came to town, and that's another person I have on my list. John moved up here, or Jack McMullen, John McMullen, he moved up from Massachusetts, ran in the Republican primary to face Senator Leahy. Fred Tuttle defeated him, and then Fred just endorsed Senator Leahy that year. And so, but he spoke beautiful sense, Fred Tuttle. And that's not a crazy idea, Fred. All right. We got another Fred. Oh, the Freds are coming out today. We got Fred in Montpelier. Hi, Fred. Go right ahead.
Yeah, Fred from Montpelier, and I just want to make a comment.
Yeah.
I'm disappointed that Governor Scott's not going to run. I mean, I think he did an outstanding job of governing the pandemic, and I'd like to see him go, and I know him, but I can't talk him into it. But I'd like to see somebody way younger than me running.
You know? So, Fred, is that inside information you're giving us? You know that the governor is
I just what he said publicly. Yeah.
Okay. Well, what he said publicly so far in the past is he had no interest in it, but right now definitely thinking about it. So there is that possibility. I would think the only other position he'd run for other than governor would be for Senate, probably not the congressional seat. I don't know if Phil Scott has the heart to leave Vermont for any extended length of time and to get involved in Washington politics, but we all know that he would be an outstanding candidate, an outstanding representative.
And I'm sure he's real tired from these last two terms in Vermont,
yeah.
But I'll call his line and put my 2 cents in.
All right, Fred. Let him know. I think I have him on next Wednesday. I'll let him know that Fred from Montpelier has advanced his nomination for the U.S. Senate. Thanks very much.
Definitely. Thank you.
Take care. All right. Let me run through a few more. On the Republican side, I mentioned Jack McMullen, another businessman who did run and didn't win, ran for Congress against Bernie, but Rich Tarrant, still in Vermont, still doing a lot of things. Brady Tensing, the lawyer who has represented the Vermont Republican Party, he's been behind the scenes a lot, but maybe he's someone who will finally step up. Let me flip over to the Democratic side. There's Deb Markowitz, who used to be Secretary of State, ran for governor, did not win in 2010. Deb Ingram ran statewide. And when I say I'm throwing these names out, they could be for any open statewide position. So Deb did run for lieutenant governor last time. That, you know, if Molly Gray runs for Congress, let's say, that opens up. Matt Dunn, who's run some good statewide campaigns. There's another Democrat we'll throw in the mix. I saw pics of people skiing at Mad River Glen. Did any of you get out and do some skiing yet? And I'll keep nominating people to run for the offices that just might come open in the wake of Senator Leahy's announcement yet on Monday. Let me just pop off a few more. On the Republican side, Miriam Berry. Mark Donka, who ran a couple times against Congressman Welch and didn't win, but he might come back around. I'm going to throw out Anson Tebbets, Lindsey Curley from Governor Scott's cabinet, Scott Milne, who's run several times on the statewide ballots. On the Democratic side, Shap Smith, Rebecca Holcomb, Christine Hallquist, Scudder Parker, Doug Racine, names from the past. Possibly. We might hear from any of those. All right. Next up on the phones, we're going to Facetown. We've got Cindy. Cindy, are you going to announce your candidacy for anything this morning?
Yes. A couple, just people that make sense to me. I can right. understand.
Sure.
One is Farmer Dave.
Oh, yeah, okay. I'll put him under the one. Independent list. All right.
Okay. Yeah. Is Kaya Winchell.
Oh, my goodness.
just thinking. They make sense to me. I can understand them.
That's good. So in that vein of Fred Tuttle,
you've
got Farmer Dave and Kaya Winchell. All right. I did give her the opportunity to announce her candidacy. She hasn't yet, but, you know, she's probably lining up big sponsors and a campaign committee and all that. So,
well, I'll keep my ears peeled.
All right. Thank you, Cindy.
Yes.
One vote for Kaya Winchell. That's pretty great. Thanks for that, Cindy. All right. Let's see what else we've got here. Before I go back into my fully comprehensive list of everybody and anybody who could possibly run for office next year. And remember, here's what could happen. If Congressman Welch decides to run for the Senate, if Governor Scott decides to run for the Senate, and then people jump into other races. Let's say, again, this is all surmising, but let's say Lieutenant Governor Molly Gray decides to run for Congress. You know, all these movements open other races, and Molly Gray would probably not be unopposed in the Democratic primary and definitely in the general election. So there will be people with names on ballots. H. Brooke Page, who has run for everything and anything on the Republican side. I think he's even run on the Democratic side at times. H. Brooke Page, who lives in Washington, Vermont, is probably getting posters ready for about seven different positions that he'll run for next year. So this could be very exciting. All right, before I get back to my list, I mentioned the Danville Wild Game Supper, which is tomorrow, if you haven't paid attention. And this is the 101st year. It is the longest-running Wild Game Supper in the state. I will be attending. Alas, it's drive-through again this year. I always love going. I think it's at the Lutheran Church, and you would normally wait upstairs. The band would play for you. And then when your time came for your seating, you'd go down, get in line, and there'd be the women with pies, all kinds of great wild meat pies. The bear was fabulous. They would try to entice you with their beaver pie, or there was moose and elk. I think they even do a chicken for those who aren't that wild, who like food but not necessarily wild game. But then you sit family style at tables and enjoy, and then there's great dessert pies afterwards. So if there's any other wild game suppers going on this year, you better call me and let me know, because I'll buy a ticket. All right. Who should buy a ticket for office next year? Let's keep my list. This is the most comprehensive list anyone has collected so far. John Klar. I'm starting at the Republican side again. John Klar. Deb Bilodeau, who just left as party chair. Vince Aluzzi, senator from up in the kingdom, has not run for anything in a while. I think it might have been AG he ran for several years back. I keep throwing out, you know, maybe an out-of-state business person comes in to bolster the Republican ticket. Or Joe Benning, another senator from the Northeast Kingdom, who has some good statewide mojo, and I think he's got the kind of appeal for both, you know, both sides, left and right, that could get him a position. On the Democratic side, Dan Frylich is a guy who has, like I mentioned, Mark Donca on the Republican side, who's run in the past, hasn't gotten much traction yet, but who knows? Steve Howard ran several years back for lieutenant governor against Phil Scott when Phil was first elected. Charlie Merriman has run. He's a possibility. Phil Baruth, who I had on yesterday. And how about this for governor? At some point, he's got to run. Thomas Chittenden. He's the descendant of Vermont's very first governor by the name of Thomas Chittenden. Come on. It's perfect symmetry. Right? All right. Let's go down the list of progressives and possible independents. Cindy mentioned Farmer Dave and Kyle Winchell. Dave Zuckerman, possible run again. Oh, Spaceman Bill Lee. There you go. That's one from Danny that I forgot. Oh, Bill Lee. He'll disown me for not putting him on my list. There's Tim Ash, Chris Pearson, Anthony Polina. These are all people who have either run statewide or seem to have ambitions to do so. Oh, Spaceman Bill Lee. How could I leave him off, Danny? Peter Clavel, who has run for governor. He was the mayor of Burlington, progressive. Mary Powell, I don't know what her party affiliation is. She was with Green Mountain Power. Just took a new position, so I'm not sure, but you never know. Ollie Jang, who's on the Burlington City Council and is indeed a possibility to go statewide. I'm going to throw out a guy who I worked with at Vermont Public Radio. He's the dean of the State House as far as media. He once ran for, I think, state rep or state senator as an independent. Bob Kinzel, loved campaigning, knows the issues as well as anyone in the state. And he's probably, if he hears this right now, just guffawing. And then for name alone, I'd love to get Boots Wardinski back into the race. I miss Boots. He hasn't run in a while. All right. If you've got some ideas, we've got about a minute to go. I'm going to get through the rest of my list. On the Republican side, again, I think a rising star from St. Jay, Representative Scott Beck. How about Thomas Lozon or Chris Loris, former mayors in the state? Jason Gibbs, who's run for Secretary of State. On the Phil Scott staff, there's Brittany Wilson, Kendall Smith, Jade Pearson Johnson, Rebecca Kelly, Heidi Sherman, the representative from Stowe, and Wendy Knight, who was the tourism director. All right, here we go. Down the list of Democrats. I'm going to get these all in. Coach Christie, Kaya Morris, Mary Hooper, Mitzi Johnson. Does she come back? Avram Pratt, Dan Noyes, Lucy Rogers, a young star on the Democratic side, Patrick Winburn, Ethan Sonneborn, remember him, the 14-year-old kid who ran for governor? I remember him. Rachel Siegel, who's run statewide a few times. All right, that'll do it. That's the end of the open phones. We'll be back with Bob Ney right after this break for the news. And don't forget, coming up today at 1 o'clock, it's the Vermont Conversation with David Goodman, followed by the Getaway with Sir Greg Hooker. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
At the Warren Store, we are busily preparing for the coming season of gatherings with family and friends. Upstairs, we have a stunning selection of Vermont's Laura Zindel pottery to grace your holiday table and a beautiful new line of honey-infused skincare. There are pillows and rugs to feather your nest and wooden jigsaw puzzles, toys, and games. Catan, anyone? Always free gift wrapping and still the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. So come for lunch in our Rockin' Deli and treat yourself to unique, fashionable finds upstairs. Open 7:30 to 5 daily. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Village and WarrenStore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Sangary. We spent a lot of time speaking with people yesterday about Senator Leahy's decision to retire. It is a major announcement in our state, but it also has national repercussions. And I thought it was a good time to call up Bob Ney, chat with him about the news. Bob, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hey, thank you, Rick.
You're welcome. Did you ever have any close dealings with Senator Patrick Leahy when you were in the Congress, Bob?
I mean, I knew him and, you know, was at events where he was at. I never had a dealing with him where I was doing a piece of legislation with him as I did with, you know, some other members, including Ted Kennedy. But of course, I was around and he was in meetings and hearings and events. And so I knew who he was, obviously. But no direct interactions. I can say that I sponsored a bill with Bernie Sanders, but not Senator Leahy.
Well, what was that one with Bernie?
Oh, it's a great story. And by the way, I wanted to say right up front, I was accused in 2016 publicly of being a shill for Bernie Sanders. I had told this story. Bernie Sanders came into my office as Bernie Sanders. He was a House member. We served on the same committee. As he normally would, he had an armful of, you know, folders and information because he actually reads things. Mm-hmm. And he came in and he started to go all through what he wanted to do about a great concept, a great bill, where you would do the consumer price index. You would alter it for seniors so that the cost of living increase would be based on things that actually affect seniors. For example, when the computer prices went down, they said, well, seniors don't need as much cost of living increase. Well, that's kind of ridiculous how many seniors were using computers. So anyway, Bernie came up with this great plan. He really did, how to recalculate the cost of living for seniors. And I said, yeah, at the end, I said, Bernie, I'll go on this bill with you. And he looked at me and he said, I'm no dummy, he said. You're in a position here, and he said, you authored the bill, and I'll go on it with you. And he started smiling, and I said, okay. And so that's how we authored that bill.
I
thought it was a great, you know, he basically, he did have pride of authorship. He just wanted something to get in, you know.
Yeah. Oh, that's a neat story. Well, yeah. Bob, talking about Senator Leahy, give us an idea of the kind of influence someone with 46 years in the Senate can wield.
Well, a lot. And then, you know, like I said, I didn't do legislation directly with him, but I obviously, you know, knew who he was. And our office on certain issues would deal with, you know, with his office, obviously, because, you know, you do that when you've got legislation. It's going back and forth that you all have interest in. But, you know, he was a senior. He is the most senior member of the Senate. He came in, I think, during the water, what they called the Watergate babies.
You are correct.
He got elected right after after Watergate.
Yep.
And he, at one time, I know he chaired Judiciary Committee, obviously. Everybody knows that. I think he chaired also at the Agriculture Committee at one time, you know. And he, of course, presided over Trump's impeachment trial. But basically, you know, if you look at his whole career, his experience, you know, the relationships he's promoted and fostered, because he's got respect from both sides of the aisle. This isn't someone that people would say, oh, it's Leahy. That, you know, I think people, you know, respect him quite a lot. And so it's going to be, I mean, there's no use to downplay this. It's going to be a loss. You know, he was on chairman of the committee on appropriations. That's huge. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, judiciary. So, yes, it will be a loss. Now, luckily for Vermont, I'm going to be a shill here again. You have Senator Senator Sanders.
Right.
And then you have Congressman Welch, who came a year after I left, so I don't know him. But, you know, he's done a lot of work. Congressman Welch, I would note, because, you know, I kind of keep up from other members, he has been respected for being able to work bipartisan, in a bipartisan nature. Now, here's the point, I guess, about the Senate. You know, if the Senate flips and the House flips,
right,
does one say, oh, well, we might as well just put in Republicans because, you know, they're not, you know, Democrats aren't controlling the government anymore. Well, it could switch back every 2 years. So I never liked that argument too much personally on either side, you know. But I think it'll be important who will take his place. It'll be important for the state. You are, luckily, like I said, you've got Senator Sanders, who's, you know, been around. But it's going to be important who takes the place because, you know, smaller states acquire a lot of power through people like Leahy and Sanders and Welch. They just do.
Right.
And I don't want to sound like I'm, you know, bragging here because I'm not trying to, but I was made vice chairman of a full committee after I was in office 30 days by Newt Gingrich.
Wow.
And eventually I became the first chairman out of that class in 5 years, and I chaired two committees. And I must say, believe me, I got highway money and projects and all kinds of things for the district. And I had an Appalachia district, which virtually was ignored prior to that. And so, you know, I did that. I left, you know, when after I resigned. And frankly, the district's never gotten that clout back.
Right.
You know.
Well, no, so, Bob, it's not bragging.
Got to work it.
This is the way Washington works, and it's important for us to hear it from an insider. So I really appreciate that very candid look at what happened in your situation and your look at what could happen with Vermont. Excellent point that we do have Bernie Sanders still there, who's been since 06. It's with all likelihood, it looks like Congressman Welch will probably run for that open seat, but I'm sure the Republicans are right now looking to find who they could get. Governor Phil Scott would be the definitely ideal candidate from the Republican side, but he is such a homebody, it's hard to believe he'd leave Montpelier for Washington, but we shall see, right? Let's take a look. You know, this was a lock seat for Democrats if Senator Leahy runs for re-election.
Yes.
Now it probably moves to leans blue in play. So what kind of national attention, and, you know, that means PAC money, advertising, et cetera, will Vermont see if the Republicans come up with a really viable candidate for this position?
Well, I think a lot of things that the Republicans will look at is history, too.
Mm-hmm.
If my memory serves me right, Senator Leahy was the first, and Congressman Welch were the first two Democrats to be reelected to those positions.
Senator Leahy is the only Democrat ever elected to Senate from the state of Vermont.
That's right. And I think Congressman Welch was the first one to get reelected, if I remember right.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that the Republicans will look at some of that history. Well, yes, Leahy's been there a long time, but after all, look how long it took, you know, for the Democrats to take the seat.
Right.
And so they'll naturally look at it as an ability to take it back.
Yeah.
That's the way they've got to look at it. Of course, it's going to depend on the candidate, you know, that they have. So I think it's going to be, a real if they get the right candidate, it's going to be a real food fight in there. And, of course, your state will experience more out-of-state visitors than they've had in a long, long time.
We love tourism, Bob.
You're going to have it. You're going to have it from almost 40 or 50 different states. So you're going to have it. Because, you know, they bring in busloads of people.
Yep.
Both sides do it. They recruit. They get volunteers. They do this. And then, of course, the money spent. I hope you all are a beneficiary of that money.
That's right. Well, speaking of money, you know, one thing that Senator Leahy has amassed is a war chest for reelections. There's probably millions sitting in it right now. What happens with money like that that's built up over years?
up to 1995, I believe, when I came into Congress, right prior to that, you were actually allowed to keep all of the money on a personal level. You were allowed to keep it and pay taxes on it. That's the way it used to run. That was stopped because people complained about it. So that was stopped before I got to Congress. The current law is that you can use your campaign account for the benefit of your political future, basically, and political needs. You just can't use it for personal use. So what that translates into is Senator Leahy or myself, when I resigned from Congress, I had a campaign account, and I disposed of it. I gave money to charities and, you know, different things like that. But you can do what you want with it. You could hire a secretary who answers correspondence, because Senator Leahy's been in, you know, for a long time.
Right.
People will still correspond. You can lease a car if a person wants to. You can use it to go to fundraisers for other people. Anything that is, quote, political, you know, or politically oriented. Some people do that. I don't know what Senator Leahy will do, obviously. Some people do that. Or you can give the money away to charity, or you can give it away to other candidates.
Very interesting.
You can be a kingmaker if you want.
Yeah. Bob, this is great information. Always wonderful to get your perspective. Usually we talk about current events. This is kind of a current event, but I did want to get your
it's a big deal for Vermont.
Yeah. National correspondent Bob Ney, thank you so much. Now, I should remind people, it's going to be really great because Bob will be on with Governor Jim Douglas this Friday in his regular slot at 10 o'clock. I can't wait to hear it. So thanks, Bob.
Thank you.
All right, take care. Yes, we're an old state, and sometimes our laws can be a bit antiquated. Some Vermont distillers feel that way about the state's liquor laws, and they'd like to see some changes. In this week's 7 Days, food writer Jordan Berry takes a look at what those changes could be, and she joins us now. Jordan, thanks for being with us this morning.
Hi, Rick. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. So how has the Vermont micro distillery industry grown in, say, the past 10 years, the past 20 years?
Yeah, so when I set out to look at this story about the potential changes in our liquor laws, I felt like there was really a new wave of distilling about to happen. There are some players that are just getting into the game. There's a brand new distillery opening that just opened in Bennington called Village Garage. You know, Arts Riot's working on a distillery. It seems like we're entering kind of a new phase of what could be going on. Vermont right now has 26 licensed distillers in the state. I found an old story from 7 Days in 2011 when Caledonia Spirits, which is sort of our leader of the pack, first kind of got off the ground, and there were 14 distillers licensed in the state then, up from 3 in 2004. So it's definitely grown. You look at kind of 26 versus how many craft beer distillers we have in the state, though, and it still feels pretty small.
Yeah, that's true. And you mentioned that it really is Bar Hill, Caledonia Spirits, who have taken the lead. Now, how has the pandemic impacted these distillers, both, you know, their tasting room sales, their package store sales?
Absolutely. Well, in July and October of 2021, Caledonia Spirits Bar Hill Gin was the number third most selling product in the state of Vermont liquor stores. Mm. So, and that's after Tito's Vodka, which is in two different sizes, which is sort of the national mega product there. So it's impressive that a company like Bar Hill has done so well in the state. But even them, their president and head distiller, Ryan Christensen, testified before the Vermont House Committee on General Housing and Military Affairs. They're the one that get to look at all the fun booze laws back in the spring. And he said our distillers are struggling without tasting rooms being open for, at that point, that was April or May. You know, Bar Hill hadn't opened their, Caledonia Spirits hadn't opened their tasting room on Gin Lane. And we didn't have out-of-state tourists coming at the time. So without the kind of scale of people from elsewhere coming and seeing all the great things we've got and then taking it home, Vermont's a small state. We can do as much drinking as we can in a safe way, but Well, there's only so many of us that can help support that industry.
Good point. Now, but there have been laws passed, like allowing sales at farmers markets and the drinks to go at bars. Haven't these been a good stroke for the bottom lines of these distilleries?
They absolutely have, and I think they're a good sign of what's to come. There seems to be a push in the legislature now, and with the new deputy commissioner of the Department of Liquor Control, Wendy Knight, to take a look at these laws and see, you know, something like being able to sell at farmers markets that not only reaches out-of-state tourists, that is a new place for people within the state to get to taste, get to try, and get to know a company, and maybe take a chance on one of their smaller products, you know, something that's a one-off or that doesn't make it to the state liquor stores.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think one of the things that distillers are really interested in seeing some kind of a change is it the ready-to-drink cocktail law that they're concerned about, and explain what that would be.
Absolutely. So you mentioned the to-go cocktails that happened, the two-year extension after the governor's emergency order. That mostly focuses on restaurants and bars, but distillers who do have tasting rooms are making really creative canned cocktails or bottled cocktails to go. But there's a whole category called ready-to-drink cocktails or RTDs in the industry. And those are, you know, a canned gin and tonic, a canned bee's knees that you can pick up right off the shelf, packaged and ready to go. And, you know, there are some available now in the state, and especially, you know, kind of the bigger national brands. We're not seeing a lot of them from our local distillers. Whistlepig recently released a product. It's called their Piggyback Rye Smash. That's kind of a take on classic rye cocktails. But what's interesting about that product is it's actually not spirits-based. So the big issue here with the RTDs is that spirits-based products, no matter what their alcohol content is, whether it's, you know, 40% like a bottle of whiskey or 8% like these canned cocktails are, they have to be sold through the state of Vermont's 802 liquor stores. And that's the result of our control system here in the state of Vermont. We're one of 17 states that came up with that system after Prohibition ended. Mm-hmm. And it just means that the state acts as the wholesaler for spirits and liquor and sets the prices and lets them control where they're sold. So what Whistlepig did is they actually decided to make a malt-based product rather than a spirits-based product. So these rye smashes have rye grown on their farm distillery property in Shoreham, and barrel-aged fruit that's, you know, in the barrels they use to make the whiskey. But it's actually a completely different product from their whiskey. And that means it can be sold at grocery stores and gas stations and sort of instead of just 78 of the state-owned 802 spirit stores, they can be sold at over 900 places around the state right now.
That's a bit of a difference.
That's a big difference, yeah. And so what this law that's been in front of the legislature for two sessions now hopes to do is actually take those spirits-based ready-to-drink cocktail products at, you know, that lower ABV, that 8, 12, up to 16%, depending on what level they end up with there on what they allow. And it would carve them out of the DLC's control system and let them be sold at that 900-something stores instead of just 78.
Well, you mentioned Wendy Knight, who is the deputy DLC director or secretary, commissioner, I guess. What is her opinion on how this legislation should or shouldn't go forward?
Yeah, Wendy has a really – she kind of comes from a commerce background, and she thinks that, you know, whether that's taking a couple $100,000 out of the DLC's coffers in a given year, it would be more than make up for it in supporting the businesses and all the things that come with that, as far as, you know, excise taxes, creating jobs, creating tourism, and allowing this distilling industry to really grow. So she seems to be in support of it.
Big question there. How do we allow the DLC to maintain control in a way that would get our distillers producing and selling more? And I guess we'll see how that plays out in the hands of the legislature this coming term.
Yes. Yeah. Representative Matt Byrong from Virgin said that that's one of the two priorities. He's sort of been on an alcohol modernization law trend for a few years now. He was behind that cocktail to-go legislation, and he said along with looking at some direct-to-consumer shipping for our distillers, which would help reconnect them with those out-of-state tourists, that the low-alcohol, it's called low-alcohol spirits beverages, that I think canned cocktails is a good name for them. That would be a priority starting off the next session.
All right. You can read Jordan Berry's story in this week's issue of 7 Days or go to 7daysvt.com. Jordan, thanks so much for being with us this morning.
Thanks for having me, Rick. Cheers.
Cheers. All right, let's take a break for the news. Then we'll be back to hear about the Vermont Jazz Center. And today from 5:30 to 7, following the afternoon news service, you can listen to the Brady Farkas Show, then enjoy your evening repast with Dinner Jazz with John Wilson. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
At the Warren Store, we are busily preparing for the coming season of gatherings with family and friends. Upstairs, we have a stunning selection of Vermont's Laura Zindel pottery to grace your holiday table and a beautiful new line of honey-infused skincare. There are pillows and rugs to feather your nest and wooden jigsaw puzzles, toys, and games. Catan, anyone? Always free gift wrapping and still the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. So come for lunch in our Rockin' Deli and treat yourself to unique, fashionable finds upstairs. Open 7:30 to 5 daily. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Village and WarrenStore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I always think the people who live in Chittenden County and like to laugh are lucky to have the Vermont Comedy Club in Burlington. Great comedians, or even okay ones, honing their craft. Easily accessible. Well, beboppers, scat cats, swingers, and blues fans who live in the southern part of the state have a mecca of their own for jazz. There's a place that has education programs, workshops, live performances in Brattleboro. And how cool it must be to head to Cotton Mill Hill, even that has a jazzy name, and pop in on the Vermont Jazz Center whenever something is going on. Joining me now to talk about the center and what's happening there is the director of the Vermont Jazz Center, Eugene Heumann. Eugene, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, Rick. I'm really enjoying speaking with you, and I'm so happy that you played a little bit of my song, Cumbia Dramatica, at the outset. Thank you for that.
Tell us about that. That was it's from Eugene Heumann's Convergence Quartet. So tell us right away about that. That was a beautiful piece.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Well, the Convergence Project is a band that I have that performs my music, and we go back 10 years, and that particular song was influenced by the cumbia rhythm, which I learned when I lived for 4 years in Colombia, South America. Mm. And the band is still in existence, and we play as often as possible. But, you know, with the pandemic, that hasn't been too possible these days. We had a gig about a month ago, and that was a lot of fun.
All right. Well, we're all hoping that more and more we can get past this and open up again. Listeners, to ask Eugene Heumann about the Jazz Center, or maybe you've been there and you want to share a visit you've made, you can call us 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. Eugene, as we talk about the Jazz Center, I think we have to start with someone named Attila Zoller. So who was Attila Zoller?
Thanks. Yeah, Attila Zoller was the founder of the Vermont Jazz Center, and he was a Hungarian guitar player who came to the United States to make it big. That was his dream. And he came to the U.S. and ended up playing with Herbie Mann, the great flautist. And on his first recording, Attila Zoller included Herbie Hancock, a young Herbie Hancock, as his pianist. And so he ended up becoming somebody who was quite well known in the jazz scene in the 70s. And then he had this love affair with Vermont because he came from a place in Hungary where there was a lot of woods and fields, and so he came to Vermont and felt right at home, and he bought some land in Townsend and built his own house, and then he started inviting friends up from New York to come and play with him, play music, and to enjoy the scenery and the swim and the cross-country ski, which he loved to do. And it turned into the Vermont Jazz Center. He started inviting young students up to come and perform and play with him and to study with him. And he kept a place in Queens, New York, where he also lived. But in doing so, he established this connection between New York City and Vermont of real high-caliber jazz musicians who would come here to teach and perform. And he put the southeastern Vermont, Brattleboro in particular, on the map as a jazz mecca, like you said. And he passed away in 1998. And I took over in 97. He asked me to run the Jazz Center after, you know, his passing. Or, excuse me. He asked me to run it while he was sick. He had colon cancer. And so I took over while he was still alive, and we had him perform his last concerts at the Jazz Center, which was something that he had it as a name only. And he would do concerts and workshops throughout the southeast part of Vermont. And then when I took over, like you said, we moved to the Cotton Mill, and we've been there since 1997.
Oh, that's wonderful. Tell us about the space you have there at the Jazz Center.
Well, the space at the Jazz Center is it's like a loft. If you've ever been to those lofts in New York City where they have performances, it's kind of like it used to be a cotton mill, as the name says, mm-hmm. and then it was changed into the Dunham Shoe Factory. And then now it's an incubator space run by the BDCC, Brattleboro Development Credit Corporation. And the Jazz Center took over one of the bigger spaces and converted it into a beautiful performance space with tall ceilings and great lighting and really top-notch sound gear, so that when you perform there, we have a stage, we have a 9-foot Steinway grand piano and really good backline, so performers come and they play at the Jazz Center and they love it because we've been doing it for so long. We also have an audience that has just grown up with us and are really engaged with what we do. It's a nonprofit, so the space itself is now we've converted another space that's right next door to us into an archive where we are now preserving all of our concerts that we've done over the years, which we have recorded or filmed. And we've also been accepting jazz books and CDs and have established quite a good library there as well.
Oh, that's great. All right, I hope we can get to all the stuff that you have going on there. We're going to talk, but I want to talk first about this weekend pass that you just hosted. It was the Emerging Artist Festival. So what went on?
Yeah, well, one of the most important things that we feel is that jazz is a music which is vibrant, which is alive, and which includes a lot of young people. And we also recognize and love the jazz of the golden eras of like the 30s and 40s when there was the big bands. And in fact, we on December 3rd, we're going to be doing a big band concert that is a tribute to those golden years. But also we respect the lineage of jazz and how it came up through the bebop era in the 40s and then the more adventurous times of the late 50s and into the 60s and then the electric eras of the 70s. But what we're trying to also do is to welcome the new advances that happened with younger musicians. And so we find that a lot of those musicians who are really exploring are musicians who of diverse backgrounds. And so we're trying to create a space for them in our programming. And we've been doing that all along, but 4 years ago, we chose to create a festival that happens every November that welcomes these emerging artists that are coming up in the scene that might not have the name recognition that we usually have with our other concerts that we present. and we try to feature them in the context where they will also be teaching young musicians of high school age and college age. So, for example, this past weekend, we had Val Gentil, who is a she's a turntable artist from Haiti who teaches at the Berklee Institute of Jazz and Gender Justice. And so she came from Boston, from Berklee, with 11 students who performed with her on the stage at the Vermont Jazz Center. So she did a set of solo turntable work where she includes the Haitian rhythms that she's familiar with, that she grew up with, that she plays. She grew up in the voodoo tradition, and so her family was priests in that tradition. And so she learned how to play the drums as a young woman. And then she then gravitated towards electronics and picked up the turntables and samples. And so she then got a job at Berklee School of Music and is now one of the instructors at the Berklee Institute of Jazz and Gender Justice, where the students who come to that particular institute are students from around the world who've been vetted and then come there as full scholarship students, as graduate students. So there were 11 of them. They performed together with Val. But prior to the performance, they gave a full day of workshops and coaching for high schools and colleges from the area.
Oh, wow, what an exciting weekend.
And yes.
Yeah, great way to spread the love, spread the jazz. I know you also do jam sessions. They must be great. Tell us about them.
Yeah, well, it's my belief that jam sessions are one of the pillars of jazz education. In the olden days, there was no Berklee School of Music or New England Conservatory that had a jazz program. In the old days, the older musicians would kind of coach the younger musicians by playing tunes. Mm-hmm. And they would have these music halls or restaurants or bars or whatever where they would play together. A lot of times in the local labor music, there used to be places where musicians would just congregate and play music together, and it was a local thing. Like in Kansas City, that's where, for example, Charlie Parker would go and learn that he didn't know how to play a certain tune in different keys, and therefore was needed to go back to his practice room and study. And so what we're trying to do at the Vermont Jazz Center is to create, or we already have done that, is to create an atmosphere where both young musicians and old musicians can come together and learn from each other. So this has been going on since I started in 97, 98, and we've had a jam session every Wednesday. We had to take a break during the pandemic, but we're back at it again every week, where we have a rhythm section and people come and they play music and have fun together and learn from each other and share the wealth of our legacy.
Eugene, you play piano, so 5 years ago must have been very special for you and the center when you got that Steinway D. Tell us about that.
That's correct, yeah. The Steinway D was a gift of the McKenzie Family Foundation. Mike McKenzie is one of our patrons, and he found out that I was looking for a nice piano to replace the piano that we had, which was a Yamaha C7. And I went to Montpelier, where I had heard that there was a really nice Steinway D concert grand piano that was for sale, and I played it for a couple hours and fell in love with it. And so we had the piano completely rebuilt and then brought to the Vermont Jazz Center. And they did a feature on it on Vermont Public Radio, and the first person to play on it was the great pianist Fred Hirsch, who did a trio performance. And the piano is just sounding better than ever 5 years later, as you said. And we use it for every concert. We put it away in between concerts. We do not play on it during the jam sessions. We use the Yamaha, but the courses that we run, we preserve the piano, the Steinway D, and it's in perfect condition. Everybody who comes here and plays it says it's one of the favorite pianos that they've ever played.
Well, that's brilliant. Hey, let's take a moment for you to pump your tires. Several years ago, the center received a National Acclaim Award from the Chamber Music from Chamber Music America. How big a deal is that?
Well, it's really it's remarkable that a small organization like we have here can be recognized by a national organization like CMA. It's a total honor, and we've been using that award as a means to kind of leverage the quality, just to let people know that we're of such a quality that we would be recognized by that organization, which is one of the most highly reputable chamber music organizations in the whole country. And they gave us an acclaim award, and they came and they presented it. And in that presentation, we also were cited by the state of Vermont, where Molly Burke, who is our state representative, had a proclamation done by the state house up in Montpelier, and we went there and they read a proclamation, and we received that, and we have it hanging on our wall. So we're very, very, very proud of that, and we continue to try to uphold that tradition and continue to present the highest quality music, and also to do educational programs so that we can get young people invested in the music and share the love and the knowledge of the music.
Eugene, you have a great fundraiser coming up in a few weeks. What is it? Who's performing?
Yes, on December 3rd, we have a big band that is the Vermont Jazz Center Big Band that's made of local professionals who come and they form a 17-piece big band. It's led by Rob Freeberg, who's a wonderful trumpeter and band director. And so we've been hosting that for 12 years now, and it's a scholarship fundraiser so that we can put the money towards giving scholarships to students who come to our educational programs. This year, we're featuring a vocalist named Amanda Carr, and she has sung with the Boston Pops and a whole list of, you know, fabulous musicians, and she will be singing gems from, you know, the big band era, and there will be dancing. So we have figured it out, a way that we can do that in accord with the CDC guidelines so that we can have everybody who comes to our venue will be vaccinated and will be wearing masks. And we will be playing big band music, and people will be coming to dance.
And she's got a voice like silk. Let's go to the phones, talk to Forbes. Hi, Forbes. Go right ahead.
Good morning. How are
you? Good. How
are
you doing?
What's the history of jazz? I mean, we've heard it all our lives, and we know pretty much about the blues, but what about jazz? What's the history of it?
Eugene, that's a big question.
That's
but
a big
great
question,
one.
And I'm hoping that you have about 10 weeks so that we can have a course in it.
But, I took a jazz appreciation class in college, and I'm very glad I did.
Yeah, no, I appreciate the question because the history of jazz is so rich. And you're right, making the connection between jazz and blues, because jazz came out of the blues, and it came out of the slave songs, and it came out of the African-American experience, and it has evolved over time. It kind of, the birth of jazz happened in the early 1900s, and many people say that New Orleans was the cradle of jazz because there were certain kinds of conditions in New Orleans where the slaves were allowed to play their drums that enabled this music to propagate, to connect with the big band, to connect with the marching band music that was also popular during that time. So with the connection of the blues and the popular music of the time, the language of jazz that encouraged improvisation and kind of developed the sense of swing evolved during the early 1900s and then went from that New Orleans kind of potpourri to the gumbo would be a better word, and then went and up through to Chicago and spread throughout the country, including New York and L.A., and just has evolved over time as a music that welcomes innovation and creativity.
I love it. That is a great brief history of jazz. Thanks, Forbes, for that question. It seems like, Eugene, You have an event, a live event, every month. So what are some others that you have on the horizon?
Thank you, yes. What's happening is our next event will take place, like I said, on December 3rd. That's a big band event. And then in the new year, we will be welcoming on January 22nd, Ambrose Akin Musiri. Now, Ambrose is probably the most visionary trumpet player on the scene right now. It was really hard to get him to come to the Jazz Center. I've been trying for 3 years. So he'll be coming on January 22nd, highly recommended concert. That's on January 22nd. Then another emerging artist will be performing on February 19th. His name is Joel Ross, and he'll be playing, he's playing vibraphone. And he is, again, another leader that people are looking towards as to kind of demonstrate what the future of jazz will be. Then in March, we have March 12th, the George Cables Trio. George Cables is one of my favorite piano players living today. He's a master who has played with some of the older famous saxophone players and such. He has his history, if you can go online and check him out. George Cables is one of the most notorious pianists on the scene today. And so we continue to have a concert every month. And just go to our website, which is www.vtjazz.org. We'll have a piano festival in April, which we've had for 6 years now, or this will be our sixth year. We do concerts that feature the solo piano. That way we can feature our 9-foot Steinway grand piano and have people talk about what the techniques are that goes into playing solo jazz piano. So that's another weekend event like the Emerging Artists Festival that we're very proud of. So we got all kinds of stuff, and people can find out about that. And we also have educational programs that people can find out about on our website, including a summer workshop, which is quite noteworthy.
Oh, and Eugene, you stopped just short of May 21st of next year. The Eugene Human Convergence Project will be performing live as well at the Vermont Jazz Center. What an absolute gem that we have here in the state, and I want to thank you so much. Eugene Human is the director of the Vermont Jazz Center in Brattleboro, and like you said, go to the website for all that information, vtjazz.org. Eugene, thanks for visiting with us this morning.
Thank you. It's an honor talking with you, Rick. I really appreciate the opportunity.
All right. You take care. We're going to take a break for CBS News. We'll get an update. Then we'll be back to discuss Alzheimer's and those who care for loved ones suffering from this disease. And a reminder that today at 11 o'clock, we've got Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
At the Warren Store, we are busily preparing for the coming season of gatherings with family and friends. Upstairs, we have a stunning selection of Vermont's Laura Zindel pottery to grace your holiday table and a beautiful new line of honey-infused skincare. There are pillows and rugs to feather your nest and wooden jigsaw puzzles, toys, and games. Catan, anyone? Always free gift wrapping and still the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. So come for lunch in our Rockin' Deli and treat yourself to unique, fashionable finds upstairs. Open 7:30 to 5 daily. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Village and WarrenStore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. Over the weekend, I read an outstanding piece regarding Alzheimer's and Vermont's long-term care system on vtdigger.org. It's quite compelling and worth your time to find it and read it. November is National Family Caregiver and Alzheimer's Awareness Month, and so this is a perfect time to discuss the disease and the plight of those with it and those who are caring for loved ones with Alzheimer's. Joining me now to discuss these issues is Tracy Farnsworth, a caregiver and the author of that editorial. Tracy, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And we have Meg Polite, Policy Director for the Vermont Chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. Meg, thank you for being here as well.
So excited you're doing this show.
So am I. Now, listeners, to ask a question about Alzheimer's or caregiving or to share your own experiences, you can call us at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. Our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Meg, educate us about what Alzheimer's is.
Well, Alzheimer's is, you know, most people know it's a form of dementia. It's the most prevalent form of dementia, but there are many other forms of dementia out there, and they sort of use Alzheimer's as the overall term for anyone facing cognitive decline, dementia in their life. And most people know Alzheimer's as a disease of elderly people, but it actually can strike at any age. There are many Vermonters that also face younger onset Alzheimer's, but right now there's, you know, more than 13,000 Vermonters living here with Alzheimer's disease, and we are seeing that number go up because Vermonters are living longer, and the primary risk factor for Alzheimer's and other dementias is getting older. So we are working really hard with folks like Tracy and you know, the Department of Health and others to put systems in place to help support people living with Alzheimer's and those who care for them as family members or professionally.
Tracy, tell us about your involvement as a caregiver.
Well, my mom was diagnosed, I think, officially about 9 years ago, but she'd been showing the signs about 13 years ago. And my dad was her caregiver to start with, but he died in 2017, which kind of threw the ball to my brothers and I. And we found he'd been hiding a lot. So he'd given up trying to take her to the doctor because that's one thing. She hates getting in a car and going anywhere. And we did all the catching up on that. But then it reached a point where she was going outside at 2 a.m. to go for a walk, but then she wouldn't know how to get home. And it was at that point that we made the decision we weren't enough. We didn't have it in us to care for her and hold full-time jobs.
How difficult, Tracy, is that to see that change in your mom?
I mean, it's hard, and there's no way around it because she was a very active person. She was a PTA leader. She was at Ames Essex for almost 20 years, I want to say. And then she went into bank, but then there was one day where she looked at me and she's like, I don't know how to count money anymore. What's wrong with me? And Alzheimer's was her biggest fear, so it became to something people don't realize with Alzheimer's. She wanted to kill herself. She kept asking me, help me, do it. And as a kid, I mean, you're now the parent to your child telling them, no, that's so wrong. But then there's also that little piece in the back of your head that's like, she knows she's declining. She's scared to death. What do you do for her?
It is difficult to watch. Meg, you mentioned there are 13,000 Vermonters with Alzheimer's. How many caregivers do we have in the state?
Well, right now, it's really hard to know exact numbers because, you know, there's different systems we use for reporting, but the number that we are celebrating and really trying to raise awareness around this month as we thank those family caregivers, those are more than 25,000 Vermonters who are supporting their loved ones through unpaid caregiving, as Tracy's talking about. So these are not people in long-term facilities or paid caregivers, but the unpaid family caregivers. And to me, it's incredible as we think about that they are providing something like 36 million hours of unpaid care, which is, you know, $700+ million that we are seeing in our system. And, you know, as Tracy spoke to, I think some things that people don't really wrap their head around is it's a 24/7 job. You know, Tracy spoke in her article about her mom not really sleeping. And that's something I hear over and over again of people who are family caregivers just having their lives really disrupted by trying to be on every minute of every day. The majority of them, well, more than half of them are women, as you can imagine, and almost 20% of those folks need to leave the workforce because their caregiving duties are just too burdensome to manage and manage a job at the same time. So this is something that's hitting a lot of Vermont families and a lot of people who are really struggling to try and do what's right for their parent or spouse or brother or sister and probably manage their own family and work at the same time.
Yeah, excellent point. Tracy, firsthand, what are those challenges that caregivers do face when a parent or a loved one is going through Alzheimer's?
Well, one of the biggest, especially for people around my age, because I'm before I can retire, you have to balance a job with your parents. And I'd been taking care of my kids, so I was a stay-at-home mom for almost 2 decades. And I just reentered the workforce. And then all of a sudden, my mom needed me, and my boss was like, you have 2 choices, quit or find somebody else for your mom. So I had no choice but to quit. And thankfully, I was able to go back to the clients I'd worked for from home, and they needed me still. So I was able to try to balance the writing work I was doing for them with the care my mom needed. But even that became too much because she wouldn't sit still for more than 2-3 minutes at a time. Mm-hmm. And then you also have, you're isolated because you're there 24/7 with a parent. You don't have time for your friends, your spouse, any of that, and you end up needing to find the balance. And in my mom's case, she became so angry that she would push me out of the way to get away because she's always wanting to go home. Even if she was at home, she wanted to go home, which is very, very common.
Yeah.
And eventually we decided we didn't have it in us, and so we started trying to find her an assisted living place that would take Alzheimer's patients. And the first one, they thought they could handle her, but within a month, they were like, we can't do it. So then we found a memory care community that did take her for about 3 years, and they were fantastic. Yeah. But even there, she would try to get out all the time. Mm-hmm. And money runs out because assisted living, we were paying over $7,000 a month.
Right.
And, yeah, so then she ended up, we were warned, you know, when she's at a point where she's going to be running out of money, you need to find her a Medicaid facility. You need to private pay. So we did that, and within a month, or it was 2 weeks, I got a call from the hospital that they dropped her off because they couldn't handle her. And what did we want to do? Mm-hmm. And so even if you think you've got your parents set and with the right caregivers, it's still not always enough.
Tracy, we went through this with my mother just over a year ago. And so I'm hearing you kind of speak exactly the experience we had. So I'm kind of flashing
back.
It's
not uncommon because I've got a cousin right now who's going through the exact same thing. And she's got a little kid at home. And she has a very angry mother-in-law who's like, I don't like you. Get out of my house. And they reach out for help, and they're told, you know, there's nothing we can do. It's frustrating.
It is incredibly frustrating and taxing, and it can hurt. Meg, what is the role of the Alzheimer's Association in helping caregivers, those who are, supporting people with Alzheimer's?
Right. Well, the association plays a lot of different roles. And first of all, if I can just throw out our 24-hour helpline number to anybody out there, whether you're a caregiver feeling burnt out, whether you're with a family member and noticing some signs and wondering, like, is this Alzheimer's? What should we do? Or you know you'll have Alzheimer's. This is a number that has a person at it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, who can help direct you to the support you need or some of those answers. And that number is 1-800-272-3900, 1-800-272-3900. And I just want people to know that one of the greatest resources of the Alzheimer's Association is that this number is available to people because other resources do change a lot of the time. But as you mentioned in your introduction, I am the policy director here, and so one of the things that we do is we work on policy, both nationally and in the state of Vermont, to address needs, and we're certainly doing that right now. We are aware that there is an absolute acute shortage of caregivers in the state of Vermont, so some of the programs that we look at are trying to get more support for instance, the adult day centers, where for some family caregivers, they may be able to continue in that role if there's a safe place for mom or dad or husband or spouse to go during the day so that they can continue to work. And COVID has really struck that program. We've lost three of our 14 adult day centers, and there's a long waiting list for people that want that. So that's, you know, like a example of what we do. And then we have a lot of programs that we offer, educational programs, a lot of support group programs, caregiver support group programs, where people like Tracy and others can just get together and exchange information or talk to people who are experiencing the same thing and get some support of how to handle a situation or just how to take care of the person they're caring for better. And we're working, you know, with the Vermont Department of Health. They're rolling out an exciting new program now through the adult agencies on aging that's called T-Care. That's a program that's specifically focused at caregivers and how we can provide services, help them provide receive services to reduce their own stress and address some of the many things that they probably put off because of caregiving. So whether it's finding some respite support for them or getting them to the stage where they can just take a 10-minute walk if they can find someone to care for their parent or dealing with going to the doctor because they haven't been able to take care of their own care, but really looking at caregivers and saying all year long, and especially this month as we're recognizing them, this is really, really, really hard, and we're here for you, and we want to help you take care of yourself too, because we don't want caregivers to be facing secondary health implications because of the stress of this very, very long and challenging job.
I'm going to give that phone number again. The 24-hour helpline is 1-800-272-3900. And let's take a call from Forbes. Hi, Forbes.
How are you?
Good.
Listen, we could end my calling in if you would just produce programs that weren't interesting or informative.
I'll work on that.
Dementia and Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. The terms are mixed up constantly. What is the difference, and is there light at the end of the tunnel as far as research and development?
Yeah, thanks for that, Forbes. Meg?
Well, you know, there's been a lot of news lately about finding a drug that might potentially help folks, obviously not treat Alzheimer's, but start to abate some of the symptoms. And I think we've seen with the first drug coming out now a flurry of others. So the goal of our organization is a world without Alzheimer's, and we're going to continue to work towards making that happen. But that I'd say is a long way away. So as I mentioned in the beginning, Alzheimer's is a form of dementia. There are several different kinds of dementias out there, and Alzheimer's is sometimes used as an umbrella word because people recognize it, but Alzheimer's and other dementias is what we say. And for folks that really want to understand the differences between the different kinds of dementias and the differences between normal forgetfulness as you're getting older and Alzheimer's, I would really encourage them just to go to the Alzheimer's website at alz.org, and there's a ton of information there, but it can get quite scientific and more difficult than this radio show probably has to explain all the different pieces of it. So we're going to fight for an end to this, and in that interim, you know, what we offer folks are ways to make the life easier and better and more engaging for people who have Alzheimer's, and doing that in a big part is helping those who are caring for them be able to do that in a way that they know is right for the person they're caring for.
Tracy, the piece you wrote was honest and open, and why it couldn't have been easy to do. So why did you feel, though, you had to do this and share it so publicly? Who do you hope it touches?
Just really anyone, so that people know they're not alone, because that was one thing. Until now, we didn't realize that our mom would end up in New York, and right now she's completely out of reach because they have a COVID breakout in the nursing home she's in. So it looks like for at least a month we won't be able to see her at all. And she's entering into the end stages now because she's bedridden. She's in a wheelchair. She doesn't talk to us anymore. And so just other people need to know they're not alone. There are others out there like that.
we were lucky with my mom. She Zoomed with us twice a week, and sometimes she wouldn't recognize us, but sometimes those glimmers, she did, and it was pretty wonderful.
Yep. Meg. See, my mom will not Zoom at all. Oh. That was one thing. And then the window, she tried to break a window to get out of the room to see us. So we can't do that. We can't rely on that one.
Yeah. Meg, how can Vermonters help those with Alzheimer's and their caregivers?
Yeah, so, you know, I talked to Tracy, and I talked to a lot of advocates, people who've experienced this firsthand, and encouraged her, if she felt so moved, to write a letter this month, because November is National Family Caregiver and Alzheimer's Awareness Month. And so I personally want to thank all those family caregivers. We know it's hard. But there are a lot of ways that Vermonters can help. And I'll just say, like, three very simple things that folks could do is, one, learn a little bit about the disease, so you know what a caregiver may be going through, and get some ideas about how prevalent it is. One thing I learned coming into this job only a few months ago is, as soon as people know that you have a connection to Alzheimer's, the stories just start coming out everywhere. And as Tracy said, there's a lot of people facing this, and we're trying to reduce the stigma. The second thing is to check in with people who are caregivers. And as Tracy mentioned, it's very, very, very isolating. Not only are you, you know, busy all the time in your house, but you have so many limitations on you. So one of the greatest things that Vermonters could do, if they know somebody is caregiving for an elderly parent, is just check in on them, give them a call, or stop by and say, hey, you know, I know you can't come out, can I have a cup of tea with you? And then thirdly, because this is, you know, heading into the holiday seasons, and that's a time that everybody is experiencing more stress, and it is more stressful for people with Alzheimer's and other dementias, and it's more stressful for their caregivers, is to find ways to support people in that role during the holidays, whether it's offering to cook something for them, or do the shopping for them, or host a meal at your house. But really being aware of the additional stress that this puts on people, and the fact that, especially because of COVID and because of limitations, as we try not to have COVID spread, people are feeling very, very isolated, and a little tenderness can go a real long way. So I hope people will thank those who are caring for others, and we'll try and raise awareness around this and how we can work together to support those who are doing the heavy lift right now.
Meg Polite is Policy Director of the Vermont Chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. Tracy Farnsworth is a family caregiver. To learn more about the efforts of the Alzheimer's Association, you can go to alz.org/Vermont. And again, the 24-hour helpline is 800-272-3900. Tracy, Meg, thank you so much for being on the program this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rick.
All right, take care. That is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivergan, and you can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at WDEVradio.com, and it is sponsored by the Warren Store, funky, friendly, and almost world-famous. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre is up next. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.